Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, in the bill here. Up coins held pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Guzu Saba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black Power, brothers and sisters, you're listening to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense nightly broadcast, coming to you live in the Belly of the Beast in Mirror KKK. Tonight, we're going to continue our three-part series. Today is day two, as we hear from Dr. Ray Winbush as he is speaking on reparations. We have a compilation of clips over the years of the Dr. Ray Winbush, a great author and multi-decade freedom fighter for reparations. So we're going to, without further ado, hear part two of a three-part series from Dr. Ray Winbush, Black Power, about reparations. Yo, let's see. Might have did a little click of the wrist a little too quickly. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to give a little build as we wait for this clip to start. Dr. Ray Winbush is an author. He wrote the book, Why Should America Pay? About reparations. It's a very key book that we who are a part of the Black Liberation Movement should have in our category, in our database, in our libraries. You can pull it up, many of his speeches on YouTube, but Why Should America Pay is a very important book in regards to the reparations movement, written by Dr. Ray Winbush. He is a professor at Morgan State University. In fact, he's been a guest on the New Black Panther Party a few times over the years addressing this matter of reparations. Earlier during the week, we played clips from Dr. Claude Anderson, who is also a strong advocate for reparations, as we will push throughout this year and beyond this campaign for reparations, as it is indeed a part of the platform of the New Black Panther Party. Not only is reparations a part of our 10-point platform, it is also a part of our 9 local objectives. So although we are most known for being out and fighting for justice, well, when you're fighting for justice, one of the key things that you're fighting for is not only legality and for restitution and for the truth to come out and for people to be held accountable. But when you start talking about restitution and holding people accountable, that's where reparations comes in. Now, I have a lot to say on this matter, but we are choosing, you know, to make sure that we lay the premise for this discussion by bringing forth brothers and sisters who have put in time, put in the scholarly work, put in the lobbying work, put in the education work of establishing a true historical precedent for reparations by addressing the current situation that we face as Black people here in America, the constant racism that is being faced, the constant discrimination that is taking place, the constant ethnic cleansing and genocide that is taking place, are being perpetrated by the same people who enslaved our ancestors, are being perpetrated by the same people who implemented Jim Crow and all of these crimes against humanity. So the switchboard is saying the clip is trying to play. I'm not certain why it didn't play already. So what we may have to do is do this thing backwards. I'm going to go ahead and try a different clip because we do have three clips.
Arthur, what you're saying is crazy, because really, in essence, what Narkin and Cobra is doing is helping to fuel the diaspora wars.
Yes.
They're actually helping to fuel it.
Yes.
I think what we may need to do too is to get people from the diaspora who support our fight for reparations as a lineage or status, you know, and you know, from various places, and have, you know, we can have a dialogue about it, because it would behoove everybody for us to be able to secure our reparations claims and within the United States, based on lineage, based on status of being, you know, descendants, and being able to help other people, rather than for people to glom on and we all drown and nobody be able to help anybody. So, Mark, yes, sir.
Okay. So I was going to say two things. The first thing is, Ray Winbush works at Morgan State, doesn't he, Roz?
Yes, he does.
So that means that he is teaching American freedmen, our kids, this bullshit.
Yes,
sir.
This
is the stuff that they're being indoctrinated into at these HBCUs, because Grant Carr is at Howard. So this is what's being taught to our kids, for them to have this view, this damn non-lineage-based view on life, as if everybody is, we're all Black the same. And it's funny to me, because Roz, when you were talking, this is my second point, when you were talking about CARICOM, he didn't want to even have a discussion about what CARICOM was doing with Jamaica. He just completely blew that part of the conversation completely off and deflected to a whole nother talking point. It's as if they don't want to hear nothing about another reparations commission being done.
Okay, Dr. Winbush, Ray Winbush is with us, ladies and gentlemen. I'm in trying to invite him up to, this is going to be a little bumpy because this is his first time. I'm going to invite you up, Dr. Winbush, if you can hear me. There are symbols at the bottom. You have two people, then you have a heart with a plus. If you push on the heart with a plus and you could click on a heart or 100, then that'll let me know. But I'm inviting you up, sir, to be able to speak. You've been invited to speak. You accept that invitation, and then you'll be up on stage. Thank you, everybody, for your patience. We're getting there. We're making this happen. He is here. I'm inviting you to speak, and you should have something that clicks on at the top. Click on that invitation, and you'll be able to come up. It should be a sign that pops up. It says, you guys see him, right? How you doing, Brother Ali?
Welcome to The Real News. I'm Eddie Conway from Baltimore. In honor of Black History Month, I have with me today Dr. Ray Winbush from the Urban Institute of Research at Morgan University. Today we're going to try to talk about reparation, the history of reparation, and the future of reparation. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Ray Winbush. Thank you for coming.
How you doing, Eddie?
Would you give me a little background on yourself and what you do out at Morgan University?
Well, I'm director of the Institute for Urban Research there, and Morgan, as you know, is the designated urban university of the state of Maryland. And what we do is do research in and around Morgan, about a 100-mile radius in the state of Maryland, on anything dealing with urban issues, and that's broadly defined. So we can be doing things and do things relative to transportation, health, law enforcement, education, and a variety of things. We're the only kind of Black think tank on an HBCU campus in the country. So we get calls from literally all over the world because people want us to provide an African-American perspective on issues involving their environments.
Okay, well, you know, over the years, we've always heard about reparations. There's been many ideas about what that means. Could you give us some insight on what this whole concept of reparation is?
Well, reparations are basically compensation when a nation has committed crimes against humanity. And then you ask, well, what is a crime against humanity? It is a crime committed by a nation towards a group of people that is widespread over long periods of time. So the most obvious one, as we know, is the Holocaust that occurred during World War II. But one that is even longer than that is enslavement in the United States, which started roughly in the mid-1600s and lasted up until 1860, and one can make a strong argument that it persisted even beyond 1860 because we've got evidence of, like, you know, chain gangs and convict labor and all of that. So reparations for the transatlantic slave trade means that this country, along with many European powers, literally built the economic base of what we call the industrial white world on the backs of enslaved Africans. John Henry Clark, the historian, once asked how many Africans were taken out of Africa, and no one knows, but his answer I always remember was, we must begin the count at 50 million. And so this is a crime of scope that lasted for 400 years. Officially, the last nation to outlaw the importation of Africans for labor, free labor, was Brazil, and that wasn't until 1888. So slavery by any definition is a crime against humanity, and reparations are trying to get these nations to say, look, we did something and we need to pay for it. And it doesn't mean that the cost will cover what occurred, but it does mean that the nation says we need to make some type of restitution to this group of people who were enslaved for over 300 years in this country.
Well, how long have this request for reparation been going on? I mean, where did it start?
Well, that's a very good question, because in my research, the only common denominator of all Africans in the diaspora, I don't care if they're in South America, in the Caribbean, North America, Europe, and definitely on the continent, the only constant that you hear politically is the issue of reparations. Africans who were scattered because of the transatlantic slave trade have always tried to achieve reparations. In this country, of course, we call it 40 acres and a mule. Some other countries in the Caribbean, they talk about restitution and reparation and return. So it's widespread. It's the only thing that unites the African world politically. And it's in this country. The first written data that we have of an African trying to get reparations was Belinda Royale, who was enslaved for 50 years on Isaac Royal's plantation, not in Mississippi or Alabama, but right outside of Boston in a tiny town called Medford, Massachusetts. And her so-called master fled on the eve of the American Revolutionary War. He fled up to Canada because he was siding with the British.
So you're saying in the 1770s?
1782, to be exact.
Okay.
And when he left to go to Canada, he left 50-something-odd Africans on the plantation, and Belinda Royale actually sued for 50 years of unpaid labor. And she wrote a petition. In fact, it's in my book, Belinda's Petition, where she tells how she had been enslaved and exploited by Isaac Royal, who, by the way, gave the first money for the law school at Harvard University. And she said she wanted compensation and for her and her daughter. And she went before the Massachusetts State Legislature. When I was doing the research, the actual petition has her ex on it. And I want to know who wrote this petition, because she certainly didn't write it, but she dictated it to a young sister by the name of Phyllis Wheatley. So all of this stuff is tied in together. And the petition is a powerful statement about Africans seeking justice in this country in 1780. So that's the earliest written documents we have of reparations in this country.
Well, give us a little insight on how this whole reparation movement grew and developed over the time.
Well, you know, it's really funny because, you know, probably if you go from Belinda to Lincoln, it's a period of roughly 60, 70 years, the American Civil War. And Lincoln, as you know, wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, or, you know, declared on January 1st, 1863. And although the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free anybody, I mean, literally, it was more of a political move to get black folk in the South to fight on the side of the North. In January of 1865, about 4 months before Lincoln was assassinated, his general, William T. Sherman, issued Field Order Number 15. And in that field order, they said that because of, it's like Lincoln knew that you don't put a people in prison, work them, rape them, sell them, maim them without some type of compensation. So he actually says there that they on the islands of the Sea Islands of Georgia, South Carolina, that you should give them 40 acres. And there is no mention of a mule. But when you sold people land during that time, it was like if I were going to sell you a Ford, you would assume that it had a motor in it. Mm-hmm. Well, if you sold land back in those days, you would assume that you get a mule with it. So
you're saying General Sherman did this?
He's Sherman. And between January, Eddie, of 1865 and April of 1865, April 14th to be exact, when Lincoln was assassinated, there were actually 400,000 acres distributed to Africans who had just been freed from enslavement.
On the Sea Islands?
Sea Islands all through Georgia, some of the richest land now, like Hilton Head, mm-hmm. all of Dufusky and all of those, were actually owned by Africans. And what Johnson did, Andrew Johnson, right after Lincoln got killed, he took those 400,000 acres that Sherman and Lincoln had distributed and gave them back for reparations to the southern owners mm-hmm. of enslaved Africans who he said needed to be compensated for their losses.
This was the rebels that signed loyalty oaths?
Right, and he gave them the land back. They gave them the land back. So from that point, you know, you move on, and you still see this, you know, consistent thread of pushing for reparations throughout our history.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever go to Congress? Was there ever an attempt in Congress?
It did.
Codified?
A sister by the name of Callie House, Mary Frances Berry wrote a book called My Face is Black and True. And she actually said that the enslaved Africans deserved what she called a pension. And she wanted to give a pension to those who had been freed from enslavement. And she actually, and keep in mind, this is about late 1880s, that she had 600,000 freed African Americans by this time sign a petition demanding Congress to pay them a pension, mm-hmm. just like the Civil War veterans had a pension.
This is Reconstruction.
This is a little bit after Reconstruction. During that same period mm-hmm. when she started doing. They actually put Callie House in jail, accused her of mail fraud, and she served time in federal prison in Tennessee. The guy who helped put her in prison was a young police officer by the name of J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, really?
Yes. So this guy's a long history. We ain't even got to Marcus Garvey yet. Callie House is the sisters were very much involved with pressing for reparations in this country. Mm-hmm. And then you go to Queen Mother Moore, for example, who was a follower of Marcus Garvey, mm-hmm. and she pressed for reparations. So there's a consistent thread. And James Forman, as late as 1969, got in front of Riverside Church in New York and demanded, I believe it was $500 million for Africans in this country. And it disrupted the 11 o'clock service at Riverside Church. Mm-hmm. And so the issue of reparations is consistent throughout American history and actually the entire African diaspora.
Okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to wrap up right now, but we're going to come back and we're going to look at the recent, more modern attempts at reparation and where that particular movement is going. Okay. So thank you for joining us.
Sure. Well, thank you, Eddie.
And thank you for joining The Real News. Welcome to The Real News. I'm Eddie Conway from Baltimore. I'm here again with Dr. Ray Winbush for part two of our discussion on reparations. Dr. Winbush is the director of Urban Research, the Institute of Urban Research at Morgan State University, and please join me in welcoming him Dr. Winbush, thanks for returning.
Absolutely.
We were talking about the modern aspect of reparation. What's been going on in the last 25 or 30 years? We looked at the history, and now I would like to see what we have been doing up until today.
Today.
Yes.
Well, you know, Eddie, reparations, they're as American as apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that several groups have gotten reparations. For example, Japanese Americans during their incarceration, and rightly so, right after Pearl Harbor in the 1940s, were incarcerated, and they got reparations under that extremely radical president by the name of Ronald Reagan. Native American groups have gotten reparations in the form of, you know, gambling casinos that are tax-free, health clinics, and so forth. The only major group in this country that has not received reparations are African Americans. So in the past 25 years, I would say, you know, in my book, I mark it at the beginning when James Forman, who we mentioned earlier, when he went into Riverside Church in 1969 and demanded reparations for enslavement. That kind of launched it. In the 1990s, Randall Robinson wrote a book entitled The Debt, in which he called for reparations. And keep in mind that during this period, you know, sisters like Queen Mother Moore had always been pressing for reparations. I would say that the Super Bowl, or at least the playoff bowl, came during the 2001 World Conference Against Racism that was sponsored by the United Nations. I attended the conference in Durban,
wait,
South Africa.
Let me just hold that thought for a minute, because one of the things that I need to be clear on is, I think in Randall Robinson's book, The Debt, it seemed like he asked for $1 trillion.
He did.
Did he? I mean, is that realistic?
Let's put it this way. You got to start at a beginning point. The Accra Declaration that you can find online was a study done by African scholars in Ghana in mid-1990s. They looked at the entire impact of enslavement on the continent. They looked at the extraction of rubber, diamonds, gold, mahogany. They looked at the kidnapping of somewhere between 50 and 75 million people out of the continent, the impact of colonialism, exploitation, and so forth. The figure they came up with was $777 trillion. There's not that much money in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But you started a point. Richard America, the economist at Georgetown, he estimated that black people are essentially responsible for about an $8 to $10 trillion transfer of labor to white people. In other words, if you paid all the millions of Africans who were enslaved in this country a regular salary at their rate, it would amount to about $10 trillion of free labor that was given. So a trillion ain't that much compared to in the scheme of things. And Randall calls for a large sum of money. But you got to begin a negotiation someplace.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's left out of that equation is the amount of Africans that were killed to execute the slave trade itself, because people didn't go willingly into those ships, so there was all sorts of combat that led to millions and millions of people dying before they extracted that amount of slaves.
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, every time I fly across the Atlantic, I view it as the world's largest graveyard, because we usually count the Middle Passage about how many people died in the Middle Passage, you know, the 2.5 journey from the west coast of Africa, the so-called Western world. But you got to count the people who were captured in villages and they were stolen. Then you got to count the people that died in the so-called barracoons, or the little prisons they made on the ocean side waiting for the ships. Then you count the ships. And then when you get on the other side of the Atlantic in South America, Central America, as well as in the North America, you got to count the first year of enslavement because there was a huge mortality rate. Because Africans in this part of the in North America, they weren't used to cold weather and died at an incredible rate. Again, getting back to John Henry Clark's figures, he said we must begin to count at 50 million. One of my professors in graduate school was John O. Franklin, and he estimates it at about 60 million. So we know that a minimum of 50 million Africans were kidnapped. Mm-hmm. And just think about all the labor, the talent, and all of this stuff that was lost, you know, as a result of this. And then we still see the impact of enslavement on the continent of Africa itself. But we also see it in how cities are built in this country, how so-called, I don't even like to use the term ghettos, but poor black communities, unemployment, this stuff is still a legacy of enslavement. And so the World Conference Against Racism.
But wait, yeah. Evan, stop you. Yeah, no, I'm going to let you talk this about the World Conference of Racism. But one of the things you said when you fly over the Atlantic struck a chord with me, because one of the things that I learned some years ago is that from Africa to America, there's a highway of bones,
right,
that's 50 miles wide
at least
and 5,000 miles long. Bones, I mean, you could actually walk off of Africa, walk down under the Atlantic Ocean, and you would be on this huge highway of white bones, and they stretch from Africa to North America, and it's calculated that there might be as many as 15 million African skeletons under that ocean.
Right.
That's mind-boggling in terms of the trail of death. They talk about the trail of tears, but the trail of death from Africa to America with us.
Well, no, I mean, it's a horrific, you know, just scenario. There's a book out called The Slave Ship. Mm-hmm. You know, we usually study the impact of slavery over in the United States, South America, you know, the Caribbean, or we study on the continent. But the machine that moved Africans from the west coast of Africa to the so-called Western world was a slave ship. And a guy that did the study at the University of Pittsburgh, he talks in depth about how these things were machines that went across those. They were really floating prisons, and sharks followed them.
Mm-hmm.
Those who got only a third, you know, a third of the people that boarded those ships, if you had 100 Africans on the ship, only about 65 roughly made it across. The others were thrown overboard.
Mm-hmm.
And you had these voyages taking place over many, many, over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, there's millions of Africans buried under those waters. There was a science to it. One of the reasons why I always have problems singing the song, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Song, because John Newton was, the myth is that he kind of reformed and wrote the song. The fact is, the only reason why he quit slaving, because they wouldn't allow him to get another ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, you know, cost effective. The average slave ship captain could easily make $70,000-$80,000 on one of these trips. That's a lot of money today. But mm-hmm. back there, you could get rich off of the slave trade. So we don't study that enough. We hear about it, the Middle Passage and stuff, but that graveyard that you talk about, I literally will look down and I say, I don't know how many millions of people are under that, the bones of people who jumped overboard, were thrown overboard, and oftentimes fell overboard by that were Africans.
Well, one of the other factors is that after 1825, when Great Britain outlawed slavery, they were confiscating ships that were known to have slaves on it. So what they would do, the slavers would have a huge boulder on the end of the ship.
That's right.
And they would have the slaves chained to it all the way down. So they might have 600 slaves on the ship, and they were all chained to each other. And if a British man of war was spotted, they would push that boulder over there and let all those slaves come up out of the cargo
hold
and go straight down into the ocean.
Absolutely.
And they were killing like hundreds of thousands like that to save their ship because they didn't want that ship to be confiscated,
It had a certain way. And see, that's why some of these conservative historians, who I will leave nameless at this point, they said, well, only 7 million came over. And what they were doing, almost exactly what you said, they only counted the legal. Most of the slavery was absolutely illegal. And so, you know, that's why when they count these slave manifests that were generated by Lloyd's of London and other insurance companies, they're just counting the legal part of the slave trade. It's probably at least four times that time. So if you take Phil Curtin's number of, you know, 10, 11 million, you'd have to multiply that by four. So you're talking about 40 million people minimum that came across, many of whom died in ways that you just said.
Let's go to Durban now. You've been like raring to talk about Durban. What happened in Durban?
Oh, my God.
And when?
It was in late August, early September of 2001, and literally something like 30,000 people gathered from all over the world to talk about the World Conference Against Racism. There have been several what they call PrepCons leading up to that. The African caucuses, and when I say African caucus, black folk from the Caribbean, the United States, the continent itself, and Europe united and said that the issue that we were going to press for was going to be reparations and to try to get the transatlantic slave trade declared a crime against humanity. And for 10 days over there, the United States, as you know, walked out of the conference. We got it passed. And it was passed literally on September the 9th, 2001, and we know, of course, what happened 2 days later on September the 11th, 2001. In fact, on the morning of 9/11, I was on Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela had been in prison for many years, and when we were coming back on shore, somebody yelled out to us, our guy said, "Dr. Wimber, somebody attacked the United States." And then we went in and saw the pictures coming out of New York, the Pentagon, and even though we had declared this great victory, and it was a victory, an achievement, it got buried during the, you know, the hysteria surrounding 9/11. But it still lived, you know, and it still lives right now. One article that was written about a little over a year ago by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Paul Coates' son, was the case for reparations.
Yes,
and it was
yes,
the most widely read news magazine article this past year. And recently, last summer, in the summer of 2013, the Caribbean, or 2014, the Caribbean nations got together in their group called CARICOM, and they are presently getting ready to sue Holland, or Netherlands, I should say, France, England, and eventually all of the nations, and France as well, for reparations because of enslavement. So it's still very much alive.
So now, in the next couple of months, something's supposed to be happening in that area here in North America. Can you share
Absolutely.
That with us? We got about a minute left or so.
One real quick. In early April of 2001, you can go to the Institute of Black World's website. We are forming an African-American National Reparations Commission, similar to what they're doing in the Caribbean. I'm on the commission as well as people like Charles Ogletree of Harvard and others, and we are going to be pressing this country for reparations. It's a long process, but it begins in April, early April of 2015, a couple of weeks, and you're welcome to come. It's free and open to the public, too.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing with us that history and insight, and hopefully people will be at that conference next month.
I hope
month
so,
after.
Too, and thanks for this opportunity to talk about it.
Thanks for joining me. And thank you for joining The Real News.
All right. Black Power, brothers and sisters, Black Power. Now, that clip was an interview of Dr. Ray Winbush that was conducted by original Black Panther, Brother Eddie Conway. In fact, Brother Eddie Conway is the person that designed our patch for the New Black Panther Party. Now, with that being said, brothers and sisters, we have a clip that we intended on playing today that was sent to us to go into this rotation. But as we started playing the clip, it seems that those people were appeared to be coming at Dr. Ray Winbush in a negative manner. And to be, you know, on point, we're not going to allow that on our broadcast. So with that being said, what we are going to do at this point is replay the clip that we played on yesterday of Dr. Ray Winbush, which it consisted of three different clips, maybe two to three different clips of Dr. Ray Bush speaking on reparations. And we will follow up on tomorrow, and depending if our brother Mama is back, possibly on Monday, but definitely on tomorrow. So let me go ahead and play that clip, because there's no way the other clips that we received are going to make rotation on this broadcast. We're not going to deal with no Negro bullshit. We're talking about reparations. There are all kind of individuals who are trying to sabotage that movement, just as they have been same type of mind state. Negro peons have been trying to affect the Black Power movement in general. So without further ado, I represent Brother Ray Winbush speaking on reparations, Black Power.
This evening on the Rock Newman Show, I sit down with Morgan State University professor, activist, and author, Dr. Raymond Winbush. Dr. Winbush discusses how he's blazed an impactful professional trail despite growing up in a family ailed by financial struggles and racial discrimination. He'll also break down how racial, economic, legal, and social divides have shaped the Black experience in America. That's coming up right now on The Rock Newman Show. Welcome to the Rock Newman Show from the campus of historic Howard University, located in the nation's capital. I'm Rock Newman, and it is my desire to inspire you with personal stories of extraordinary achievement. Dr. Raymond Winbush is an African-American scholar, educator, activist, and author. His writings have been influential in highlighting social relationships in the Black community, along with racial and criminal injustice in America. Dr. Winbush joins me now to discuss how he overcame impoverished conditions to become a professional pioneer. And he'll also break down how systematic racial, social, and legal injustices have impacted Black America. Dr. Winbush, welcome to the Rock Newman Show.
Good to see you, Brother Rock.
Thank you so much for being here. Yeah. Talking about being able to start in 100 different places.
Yeah.
I want to really go to your beginnings,
yeah,
because it's a storied history about an impoverished child sort of making it out of a maze,
yeah,
not becoming a statistic, and we want to talk about that journey. But before we go there, you did something recently where you posted a photo on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Of Muammar Gaddafi.
Oh, yeah.
And it talked about the various things that as the leader of Libya, he had done for the people. And if one reads that list of accomplishments, one finds that the Libyan people's standard of living...
Highest in Africa.
...was the highest in Africa, and so dramatically higher than it is today.
Oh yeah.
After American and Western intervention. I would like to have you to talk to us about
American imperialism, intervention in Libya, in Kuwait, in
Iraq.
In Iraq. I'd like you to give us some perspective, your perspective on that.
Well, let's start with what former President Obama said. He said the biggest mistake of his presidency in terms of foreign affairs was the invasion of Libya. Libya was very stable. It had an incredibly vibrant economy, an unemployment rate that was less than 1%. Some of the things that I listed, you know, if you were, you got subsidies for your houses, free health care, free higher education, everything. So I asked the question, why would then the people of Libya want to give all of that up? So the answer is the United States of America. There's been a systematic attempt over the past, ever since what we call now the Arab Spring, to destabilize the so-called Middle East in a variety of ways. Libya, if you look at it right before that, Gaddafi had said that he was going to try to get the African economy, when he was president of the AU, he was going to get the African economy off of the dollar so that it would be a common currency, similar to what's happened in Europe with the euro. That's right before he was deposed. I think the entire Arab Spring was a joint effort between the United States CIA, the Israeli Mossad, British MI5, all of those groups to say, let's destabilize this entire area. And part of that, and I say this with a lot of research behind it, part of that was to strengthen Israel in the Middle East. There's a much more tangled history to this than we might imagine, and it goes way back. Israel technically is safer today than it was 5 years ago even. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is, you know, comes to play with that.
Well, let me tell you, that is, that's a rather explosive...
Yeah, it is.
That's a rather explosive accusation, a charge. For the sake of full disclosure, I happen to have been in Libya when the AU met, when Gaddafi gave a speech about tying the, getting away from the dollar.
That's right.
Tying the currency.
That's right.
Of all of Africa to its mineral resources.
That's right. That's right.
When I had these earphones in my ear and I heard that speech, my first reaction was, I don't know if you'll be able to survive making this speech. Not so long thereafter was the invasion, and then he was being taken out. Now, it was no genius on my part.
No, but you had it right. You had that exactly right. You kept hearing the United States talk about Gaddafi being a dictator, killing his own people, as if the United States doesn't. And as you said, I would have said the same thing had I been at that same meeting. What you find is that the worst imaginable thing to Europe is a united Africa. Nkrumah said it back in the 50s. It's something that is dreaded because so much is extracted out of Africa. Not just minerals and how we get these cell phones working and gold and mahogany, but the idea of saying this is a continent that we can continue to exploit even after the fall of colonialism. And Gaddafi had the vision to say we can get past this, and he was putting his money where his mouth was by donating, I forget how much money it was, but donating money to start a common currency in Africa that would break some of these. I mean, you go to Ghana, they're using the pound. You go to Cote d'Ivoire, they're using the French state, I forget what the name of it. Mm. You know, all of these currencies. If you had a common currency, it would start uniting Africa economically.
So you agree with Obama that one of his worst.
Well, I think it was the worst. Mm-hmm. And he listened to a sister by the name, not a sister, but Hillary Clinton, because he really was hesitant about doing it.
Yeah.
And we kept hearing the rebels are going. Who are the rebels? What we now call ISIS, because ISIS was born out of that whole conflict.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, because you study this and you have such an incredible reputation of being very erudite in terms of being able to identify and explain motives,
mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, you say he listened to Hillary Clinton.
He did.
Why would a Hillary Clinton been so adamant about advising him as Secretary of State to invade Libya?
Well, first of all, you know, look, I mean, and I know this is a touchy subject for a lot of folks, but Hillary is a war hawk. I mean, she has a history of wanting to invade nations. The incursion of the United States through AFRICOM during the Obama presidency just increased geometrically. If my memory serves me correctly, we are now in 24 nations in Africa. It has become a proxy nation for staging a variety of things. Hillary knew that, and she wanted to further destabilize the Libya and Iran and Iraq were the three strongest nations in the so-called Middle East, besides Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The strong, all two of those nations have fallen,
mm-hmm.
Libya and Iraq. Iran, as you know, there's a reversal of policy that's being cooked right now between the Secretary of State, Benjamin Netanyahu, and I don't mean that ill-advised, and not being sarcastic, and the Trump administration to destabilize Iran, to roll back all the stuff that was made under the peace accords, under a nuclear peace accord under Obama. I think Hillary was ambitious. She wanted to seem tough.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli lobby had a lot to do with that. And she advised Obama to do that, and he said it was his mistake, biggest mistake.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned Libya and Iran and Israel. And I cannot get past this without taking this shot.
Okay.
The gentleman who occupies the White House.
45. Named after the gun.
Currently sat yesterday with Israeli officials. And he explained that his secretary of Tillerson was doing well sitting in Israel. He told a group of people, we just returned from the Middle East. Did you see that?
I did. And I thought for a moment I was having a senior moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, return from the Middle East. He's in the Middle East.
Did you see the guy from Israel?
Yeah. Like,
he was like, oh, no.
It's like the Andrew Jackson statement a couple of weeks ago that, you know, Andrew Jackson.
There would have been no Civil War.
He was dead 16 years prior to that. I mean, you know, I was on a show recently, and somebody said, well, you know, Trump is just stupid. And you don't want to say that about the President of the United States, but it's true. I mean, he does not read. And I think not, and I guess as somebody who's been around academics all my life, I think reading is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a guy that's in the moment,
mm-hmm.
about everything from foreign policy to whatever,
mm-hmm.
that he's in the moment. And there was a news article in the New York Times, editorial called The World Governed by a Child.
Yeah.
And Trump, as a psychologist myself, Trump acts like a child. Theory of moral development by Kohlberg that talks about the third stage of moral development where you're all about yourself. Children are very egocentric.
Sure, sure.
And so is he.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've become, you know, such a highly respected scholar. You're a professor at Morgan State University. Mm-hmm. As a child, you would not have been pointed to as one who might climb to those heights. Let's go back, because part of what I attempt to do here, part of what I imagine, is that we have viewers out there that have children,
mm-hmm.
that are sitting and watching this show with them.
Yeah.
And part of what I always want to try to do is not just to introduce them to Dr. Ray Winbush now, mm-hmm. professor, highly esteemed scholar at Morgan State University, but also to let them know the backstory. So let's go back.
Whoa. Well, look, you know, some people say they were raised in the hood and they really weren't. Yeah. I was.
Uh-huh. There was no doubt. You was raised in the no doubt about hood.
No doubt about hood. I was born in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I'm in Pittsburgh, rather. But my parents were waiting to have me so that they could move to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why was because my father was white-balled in the steel industry. He was an organizer and was trying to organize. Late 1940s, black steel workers who were getting, you know, inequitable pay from the steel mills, they had the most dangerous jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was white-balled. He couldn't find a job.
Mm-hmm. Why do you use the term white-balled instead of black-balled?
Because that's what it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, blackball, you know, everything black, blackmail. We know what Muhammad Ali said about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the term whiteball because I think it, as it relates to black people, because much of this stuff is racial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
and in large part, his destiny was held in the hands of white folks.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And so he moved, he went to Cleveland. I was born in March of 48. And 3 months later, we were in Cleveland. They were literally waiting for me to drop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know Pittsburgh a little. Mm-hmm. I have a bunch of relatives there, go there all the time. When we went to Cleveland, we became the poster child for eviction.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, and this is no exaggeration, coming home from school with my brother, who was a year younger than me, coming home from school hoping that when we turned the corner or wherever we were, that our stuff was not out on the street.
Man.
We got evicted 3 times before I reached the age of 8 because my father couldn't pay the rent. There were 5 of us, three boys and 2 girls.
Mm-hmm.
And we were poor. I mean, we were extremely poor.
Ray, let me ask you, man, because you just give me a very vivid picture.
Mm-hmm.
You're turning the corner, maybe almost peeping.
That's right. That's a good word.
Hoping. And it's called set out. I mean,
that's right.
We know the term set out.
Right.
Hoping that your stuff is not set out because the rent's not paid. Can you identify for us the feeling that went with that?
It was a feeling of despair. It was a feeling at that young age of embarrassment because I remember once we got evicted off of the street called Longfellow down on 55th in that area. When I came home, it was raining that day, and all of our furniture was out there. It was raining on it, and my mother had tried to throw some plastic over it to just keep it dry. We were wondering where we were going to go. We stayed in a hotel for like 2 or 3 nights. I don't know what happened to the furniture, and we moved again. We were very poor. My father, you know, my mother didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
My father had a job, but had to support 5 children, and back in the 50s, I mean, that was like hard to do on 1 salary and not a good salary.
Yeah.
So he took a second job, place called Ohio Flocco Company.
Yeah.
So he was working at E.F. Hauserman, working at nights there. We saw him sometimes on the weekends late at night.
Yeah.
But he was trying to make ends meet as best as he could.
Yeah.
I can remember when we saw the furniture, we would, you know, my brother, he would say things like, man, you know, this happened again.
Yeah.
It happened roughly about once every 12 to 13 months for 3 years in a row. Yeah.
Yeah. And your brother, older, younger?
He's younger, 1 year younger than me, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
He's deceased, played basketball for Cleveland State, Calvin Murphy, in fact, and was a social worker, ran the largest drug abuse treatment center in the Midwest, in fact, CAAA in Cleveland. He stayed in Cleveland his whole life, literally.
Yeah.
I moved around,
you
know, primarily to go to school.
So tell us about the time. I mean, so now this is when you're 8, 9, 10 years old.
That's right.
You started to have some movement that took you towards academia.
Well, I know now because I'm a psychologist that I was given the Stanford-Binet intelligence test in the 4th grade. I didn't know what it was then.
Yeah.
It was a little test, and he said, we want to find out. Now, this is a self-serving comment, but, you know, I don't mean it to be, but found out that I had a very high IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents had the choice of either advancing me 2 grades or sending me to this, I guess now we would call it a magnet school or something like that. They chose to keep me in my same age and send me to the magnet school.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 5th grade, I entered this elementary school called Boulevard. I started taking French, took algebra a couple of weeks later, a couple of years later, went straight through to high school. Then I became a goof off.
Mm-hmm.
D's and F's in what we call, what they call now middle school.
Right.
And at high school, I was just nothing but a goofball. Mm-hmm. F, I barely got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
We had the highest, biggest graduating class in the history of state of Ohio. There were 600 students in the class. I graduated something like 490th.
Mm-hmm.
So I was way down.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my colleagues now, Sharon Draper, she's a very famous children's book writer right now. And she said, Ray, if somebody told you you would have turned out the way you were right now, I was nothing but a goof off. And I'm not just saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
bad grades,
mm-hmm.
playing hooky. My parents had me say, you need to stay in school. So I squeaked out of high school, mm-hmm. and then I went to college.
Well, look, one of the reasons why I fought so hard
Yeah.
to get you as a guest, because I'm well aware of your reputation in history for refusing to talk about yourself.
Yeah, I don't like doing
that. Yeah, I know, but we're going to suspend that. We're going to suspend that for this next half hour
okay.
or so here. So you got into college.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you flip the switch?
You know, I think I flipped the switch. There were two things real quick. My brother, my oldest brother, Harold Jr., went to prison
mm-hmm.
for a manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
He killed a white man who had called him nigger
mm-hmm.
and beat him to death.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to prison for 5 years. That shook me up. It shook my brother up as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our family, it was a big story in Cleveland. And we were ridiculed. I became more introverted.
Mm-hmm.
to myself because of some of the so-called friends I had said, yeah. you better watch out for Ray. He'll beat you up the way his brother killed him.
Sure.
Oh, you know how kids can be.
Of course.
And so I became more insulated, started studying as a result of that. The other thing that happened was that I became a Seventh-day Adventist, believe it or not, and tried to retreat into that. Oakwood University, where I went to school at, was a Seventh-day Adventist school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no intention whatsoever of going to college, none whatsoever. I had planned on moving to Detroit, get a job in a car factory, mm-hmm. which was big money at that
sure,
time.
Sure.
People forget that Detroit was like Atlanta is now for black folk.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to go to college. I didn't even know the entire process. I applied to Howard, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't accept me because my high school grades were too low.
Sure.
And HBCUs, as a gift, admitted me, and specifically Oakwood University.
And this is what year?
This is about 66.
Okay.
66.
Okay. Okay. Let me ask you before we mm-hmm. we go. any memories of a numbers runner in Cleveland during that time by the name of Donald King?
Oh, come on. Look, Scatter and Donald King, Don King was on 150 Euclid.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I knew him as a kid because he had a lot of money.
Yeah.
There was also, that was when 150 Euclid was kind of the center
mm-hmm.
of black Cleveland.
Yeah.
In fact, my father always used to tell us, we passed through 150 Euclid. That was the first traffic light mm-hmm. by Garrett Morgan, who was from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
in the world at that corner. He always told us. And Don King was there. This was before he started promoting fights.
Yes,
way
yes,
before.
Yes,
he
yes.
was a gangster.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, people were afraid of him.
Yeah.
They were very afraid yeah. of him. And yeah. as you know, he killed a guy.
Yes.
And
yes.
we knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the guys that ran the neighborhood, particularly the numbers on the east side of Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
where I live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I knew him.
I got snowed in at Don's house in Florida.
And, are you kidding?
In Boca Raton in 1996.
Is that right?
He and his wife, and they told stories.
Man, that was.
They sold stories about their Cleveland days.
Winston, what was his name? Winston Willis. I can't. But 150. It was bought up by Winston. I can't think of his first, but. He ran pornography
yeah.
stuff
yeah.
up. And yeah. Don, him, and this guy named Scatter,
mm-hmm.
he ran, him and Don were kind of competing, but they didn't, you know, it was okay. Scatter mm-hmm. actually wound up getting shotgunned.
Mm-hmm.
So, boy, I hadn't thought about that in a long
yeah.
time.
Yeah,
yeah, but no, yeah. yeah. Everybody knew Don.
So you didn't have any much intention to go to, you nah. goofed off in high school, not much intention to go to college, but you ended up at Oakwood,
University.
Very conservative, very little
reactionary. Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah, Huntsville, Alabama. That's correct.
That's right.
And so you go to Huntsville, and you don't necessarily think that someone who becomes a black activist and scholar
would come out of Oakwood.
Would get that? Would come out of Oakwood.
Well, sometimes I think a lot of things in life are timing, Rock. You know, I came down there at the height of the civil rights movement in 66. Mm-hmm. Birmingham had just gone down.
Mm-hmm.
I think also my parents was dirt poor. I remember my father, when I went off to college, he gave me a check for $500. He said, "This is all I got."
Mm.
And I knew that that wasn't going to get me through college. So my second and third year of college, sophomore and junior year, I worked from 3 to 11. I went to classes 8, 9, 10, 11, ate lunch at 12, laid down for an hour, and then from 3 to 11, I worked at Huntsville Hospital as an orderly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 2 years.
Yeah.
I also felt, I knew my parents couldn't get me through college, so I said, I'm going to start making good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I regained the initiative I had in elementary and part of middle school, and I started making good grades.
Mm-hmm.
So I got scholarships in my sophomore year to Harvard, in my junior year to Yale, and I studied there, and I kind of got all of my direction at Oakwood.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I had finished, I graduated cum laude there. I got a full ride fellowship to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, I guess, partially is history.
So you end up going to, into Boston, Harvard, for example.
Right.
You said Harvard and Yale.
And Yale.
You started on both campuses.
Right, right.
But I just want to focus on Boston in 1 second, because this must have been in 68, 69 area.
That's right.
Around the time of the whole busing
thing.
It
was bad.
And Boston was Alabama.
The only part of Boston that wasn't Alabama was Cambridge, where MIT and Harvard were. But if you went to Southie, I remember one night a group of us that summer I was up there, summer of 68,
mm-hmm.
just a couple of months after Dr. King was assassinated and Robert F. Kennedy, and you could drive through what we call Southie,
mm-hmm.
and it was white Irish, and they, you know, in what you doing up in here, you better get out of here and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of stayed around Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Summer of 69, when I was at Yale, a group of kids said, look, I was studying. That was the same summer that, you know, man landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going up to New York for a concert. I said, man, I got to study. I said, where's the place at? And they told us that it was, what's the big rock festival that was up there?
Oh, Woodstock?
Woodstock.
Uh-huh.
I didn't go.
Uh-huh.
But see, Woodstock, I said, I ain't never heard of the place. So yeah. I skipped Woodstock and studied over night. So that was those 2 summers. But they turned me around.
Uh-huh.
They did.
And so then you go to the University of Chicago.
Go to the University of Chicago. I had gone to Chicago during the Democratic Convention in 68 when there was, you know, all of those riots, but left there because we knew it was going to jump off.
Right.
So then I went to University of Chicago and started studying.
Mm-hmm. And so you had this internal radar. I listen.
Yeah.
And I hear you say you left because you knew something was going, you knew it was going to jump off.
The second day we saw the police, and they were ready to get anybody. That's when Mayor Daley,
yeah.
Richard Daley,
yeah.
when he was mayor of that town, and mm-hmm. he was not playing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this was shortly, about 3 months after Dr. King was assassinated, and the cities in the United States, as you know, you remember that stuff, they were still simmering that whole summer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the convention occurred, Democratic National Convention occurred. It was bad.
Now, were you in the draft?
No. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you what I did. I got a high number in the draft, and in Huntsville,
mm-hmm.
moved to Cleveland, moved to Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to say dodged the draft,
yeah.
but I tried to get out, and the people that helped me get out of the draft was a Quaker. I was determined I wasn't going to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and they helped me get out of the, they asked me if was I allergic to anything. I told them bee stings, which I was.
Yeah.
That's how I got out of the draft.
So,
and I'm not embarrassed about saying that either.
I hear you. Yeah. I hear you. So at that time, a consciousness was developing?
It was. And at that time, Cleveland, where I was raised, and Chicago, where I studied, was kind of the center of the black nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Minister Farrakhan was there. Elijah Muhammad was there,
mm-hmm.
still alive at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hakeem Madhubuti,
mm-hmm.
The, you know, earlier named Don King,
mm-hmm.
Don Lee. So all of those people were there, and that's where I got my Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, whom mm-hmm. I'm getting ready to edit a book about. She was there. So that was kind of my political education, which had started during the, you know, this between 66 and on up. And I read a lot, too.
Yeah.
I read Black Boy. Everybody read Autobiography of Malcolm X. And so by the time I got to Chicago, I was politically educated.
Were you in Chicago when they broke in, when they busted in the door and killed the Black Panther?
I came there 6 months later, Mark Clark and mm-hmm. Fred Hampton. That happened in December of 69,
mm-hmm.
and I got there in July of 70. It was still fresh. In fact, you could take a tour at that time because the Panthers let you see where they had killed them.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew early on that had been a political assassination. Edward Hanrahan, who was the state's attorney at that time, had orchestrated that with the FBI and a black informant to have those two killed. If Fred Hampton lived, he would have united much of what was
going on. I don't want to go past this
yeah.
without maybe even you repeating what you just said as an explanation mm-hmm. for our audience here, because I think it's a relevant occurrence
mm-hmm.
in the civil rights movement
mm-hmm.
where it was where the power structure worked overtime to demean, to denigrate, and to destroy the Black Panther movement.
Oh, they did.
A movement which was playing its role in trying to liberate black folks and uplift black folks.
No.
And there's a lot to be talked about, a whole two or three shows to be done on that. But I'd like to zero back in on the United States government's role in that massacre.
Well, it had started before that. That was what we call the COINTELPRO era, as you know, counterintelligence program by the FBI. And as you know, all of the organizations were infiltrated. People forget that when Malcolm was assassinated in 65, that the man who breathed in his mouth to give him artificial respiration while he was on the stage was working as a police undercover to, you know, follow Malcolm. All of the movement was, infiltrated at that time. And what, in Chicago, there was kind of this unholy alliance between the federal government through the FBI, the local police department, and unfortunately some informants in the Black Panther Party who were working for the government.
Yeah.
And I think that still exists in a lesser form, but in terms of numbers, but in an accelerated form because of social media, that they being the government, can track the lives of black folk even better, especially outspoken black folk, because I know what has happened to me even more recently, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, I was just about to ask you, because you matter-of-factly point the finger.
I do.
And I cannot imagine that achieving the status that you have achieved, and I'm going to say fearlessly pointing the finger as you have done, I can't imagine there hasn't been some blowback.
Well, you know, it's like when I wrote my first book, The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys, we were called an endangered species. And see, a species doesn't just get up one morning and say, I'm endangered. Somebody's endangering them. So I pointed the finger at the system of white supremacy, racism, as the culprit. Well, there's certain places that I go right now. For example, I always get stopped in London. I've been asked and pulled out of line as I'm going through customs, do you have any guns on you? I mean, that blatant.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote to get my FBI file. After I wrote Should America Pay, edited Should America Pay, which is a book about reparations. And my FBI file, I thought it was going to be maybe 5 or 6, 7 pages or something like that. It was 77 pages. Took me 6 months to get it, and I only asked for a piece of it. I was giving a book reading, When Should America Pay, came out in Memphis. Saw this little white guy in the back. The next night I was in Knoxville, which is the opposite side of the state, and the same white guy was there. When I was signing books, I saw him again, ran to him, and I said, who are you? I saw you in Memphis last night. And he told me he was with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He said, we thought you needed protection. Well, I didn't need protection. And he was following me. And he said, and part of what was in my FBI file actually said, he is able to convince audience about the importance of pushing for reparations. That was in my file. So the government is still here. You know, it's not being paranoid. I mean, like James Baldwin said, by virtue of being black in America, you're going to have paranoia.
1984
still here. Oh, yeah, absolutely. In spades.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned James Baldwin's name.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Not Your Negro.
Oh, yeah.
Is out.
Which is not the real what he actually said. We know what he said, though.
But this is the platform where we can talk about what he really said.
He said, I am not your nigger. I mean, look, Baldwin, if there was a prophet in the black community between like 1950 to the time of his death, it was James Baldwin. Baldwin said what no one, I mean, except maybe Malcolm, a couple of the Panthers would say. But not only did he say it, he wrote about it, and he wrote extensively about it.
Mm-hmm.
I tell my students at Morgan State, if you haven't read The Fire Next Time, you really haven't read anything about black America. You can read autobiography, but The Fire Next Time just points, you know, where the problem was. So Baldwin was a prophet, and I'm glad this film is out. I'm glad it's staying out and people mm-hmm. are looking at it
mm-hmm.
as well, because it'll give you a glimpse into a mind that just understood everything about racism, white supremacy.
And before we leave Baldwin, I want to say to my audience out mm-hmm. there that if you got that little young kid there with you, mm-hmm. pull up a video of James Baldwin, the prophet that you're talking about,
yeah.
debating William Buckley.
Oh my God.
At Oxford. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's probably one of the greatest debates I've ever seen in my life. And Baldwin, I probably, the two people I quote most in my social media, probably Baldwin and Toni Morrison,
mm-hmm.
because they just have a laser-like vision of the state of African people all over the world and the state of white people and all over the world. And that debate between Buckley and Baldwin is classic.
Yeah. When you talk about African people all over the world, not very far leap
yeah.
to think about Pan-Africanism.
That's right.
Think about Pan-Africanism, you don't get very far without thinking about a brother that came through this campus right here.
Kwame Ture.
Named Stokely Carmichael, who became
Kwame Ture.
Yeah. Your reflections on
him. Oh, man. I mean, just, you know, you're naming the greats, you know, and Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture articulated the anger that was in African America, but also articulated towards the latter part of his life the anger and what African people must do. It's like John Henry Clark said, black folk always talk about where we were dropped off on the slave ship. We were dropped off in Jamaica, South Carolina, South America, and Brazil, mm-hmm. all through the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, instead of us always talking about our differences about where the ship dropped us off, we ought to talk about where the ship picked us up. And see, I think that's what Kwame Ture did.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about and lived the life. I met him one time in Ghana, sat down with him for about 3 hours, and just, he's one of those brothers you just listen to,
mm-hmm.
and you got so much. And he had a vision of a Pan-African world that we have struggled to get since Sylvester Williams in the 1900s did, Du Bois and others, when I taught at Fisk. I mean, how Du Bois envisioned this, and Kwame Ture was trying to put that in action. And I still think we are still in that process of, you know, establishing a true Pan-Africanism throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. He carried that to his dying breath.
He did. Mm-hmm. And I always tell my students, too, read his last letter to the world, in which, as you know, he died of prostate cancer, and he talks, and even in that last letter, he points to fame. He said the CIA had developed ways of giving black men prostate cancer. And he was always just constantly being a political person. And I admire that in him. He has some flaws, as all of us do, of course, but he stayed true to the game,
I want to talk to you about your book and the structure and the advice for developing strong black men.
Yeah.
Just before that, I just recently read comments from Malcolm where he talked about, Malcolm X talked about violence.
Yeah, you did.
And he held a mirror up to white America.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, let me explain to you what violence is. Violence is making up, having us to look at a tree and hate that tree.
That's right.
So that we don't ever try to find its roots.
That's right.
And that's what you're talking, that's what you did to us as a people.
Exactly.
And as we talk about the whole Pan-African concept, that concept that Stokely had, which I mean, literally I called him in a very faint voice. He would answer the phone, ready for the revolution.
That's right.
He's
That's
still
right.
ready for the revolution.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's talk about your book.
Well, I got to say something about Malcolm. I think the term self-defense, and you know, mentioned what Malcolm said. Yeah. It's funny how the term self-defense was a common strategy to be discussed during the 60s, Deacons of Defense, the Republic of New Africa, Black Panther Party, all of these groups. And somehow we've now taken it off the table. I think it's a great thing that we've seen gun sales since the election of 45 in the black community soar. Now, some people say, oh, my God, he's advocating violence.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm waiting for the FBI to come to this door right now to pick you up.
Well, but see, what it is, we're talking about self-defense. We're not talking about what happened to the young brother at Bowie State a week or so ago or anything else like this.
Past weekend.
We're talking about self-defense and how we defend our communities.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I named my book The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys.
Yeah.
And the reason why I named it, because, again, warriors don't just go out and start shooting and killing people. They defend their community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the greatest expression of Pan-Africanism for black men and black women is to defend their communities, not only with a gun, but with knowledge, with camaraderie, pulling people together to talk to them, to teach them. I think defense is a broader term than we make it. So what I do in the book is simply tell you how to rear black boys in ways that will help them to be soldiers to guard, protect, and teach our communities. It's as simple
as that.
And
you wrote that book when?
Oh, my God, 2002. I'm getting ready to do a revision of it now. Mm-hmm.
So 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the proliferation of police killings of young, of black men, period.
Yeah.
Young,
and black women.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
Over the last 3 or 4 years that spawned the Black Lives Matter movement, would you modify anything in your book for these times?
I would probably be, and in the revision I'm going to be doing this, I would probably be more structured in terms of talking about the teaching of firearms for young black men. Black men already use firearms, as we can witness in places like Chicago or Southeast D.C. or where I live in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
But the gun should be for protection. And I think that energy that young black males have is being diverted in negative directions.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to train our young people, as does the white community with guns, to train their young boys and young girls to use firearms. So I would change that in the book. In light of the police department, I think the Panthers had a model. They followed police. And I think that and it's interesting now that, see, Rock, I'm going to tell you something. I don't think, and I might be wrong, I think police violence against black folk has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
What has changed is social media.
So,
everybody got
yeah,
a camera
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
they can tape this stuff, the old term tape, record this stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they can play this stuff and post it so that millions of people see it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the police have always been violent towards black folk in this country.
Mm-hmm. When I asked that question, I was wondering if you might say something, might have gone the route of speaking to how to teach young black boys
mm-hmm.
how to survive in an encounter with the police. Now,
yeah.
Before you respond, and you as a psychologist know this much better than me, but that is a very, very double-edged sword.
It is.
Where when you are talking to a kid about how to come home,
mm-hmm.
how to live, that's real important.
Mm-hmm.
That's real important. Handle this encounter in a way
mm-hmm.
where you're going to allow yourself to come home.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what you're doing when you do that is suggesting to him that he subjugate his manhood.
Well, no. Look, you are on the same page. I'm going to be honest with you. I get kind of tired when... You know, some people call Randall Kennedy calls it respectability politics, saying you've got 10 things to do when you meet the police. That always comes out after one issue. Look, Philando Castile up in Minnesota did everything.
Right.
He complied, if
right.
you please.
Right.
The brother in Oklahoma that just his killer, white woman,
lady.
Killer,
yeah.
Yeah, killer
yeah.
and I'm blanking on the brother's name. But he did everything correct. Look, I have been almost killed by the police twice. Once while I was a student at University of Chicago. And I wasn't doing anything. So this idea that if you comply, and I've heard black people, you know, expressing these respectability policies, if they would only obey the police, there's too many instances where black folk have obeyed the police and they still have gotten killed. What I advise is to tell the young man, you need to be aware, part of the warrior method say, you need to be aware at all times how racism, white supremacy can impact you in this situation, at the grocery store, at school. It can happen anytime. When I walk out of Howard University, I don't just say, wow, I'm in a place that I can relax. To a degree, yes, as opposed to, let's say, University of Maryland. But I'm always aware and have my radar up that something could happen if I'm driving home to Baltimore or any place else. So we have to teach our children to be aware of what can happen. But this stuff about if the police pull you over, there was a video a couple weeks ago, these young men, they weren't doing anything. They were 12 years old, and the cop had the gun. They were showing it. How he was pointing the gun, telling him to get on the ground. The kids were crying and everything. Those kids were too young to be doing anything. And it was just intimidation. And I think we also have to understand how racism impacts the lives of our young people, and boys and girls, and how that stuff is played out in the sick minds of white supremacists as well.
I never get tired of asking my guests who I think have a real perspective and sit in a unique vantage point to speak of Dr. Frances Cress
yeah.
Wilson. You're editing
a book yeah.
about her.
Yeah. Wow. What can I say? Frances is probably one of three people in my life, and one of them, and I'm going to collectively talk about my mom and dad, that literally shifted my worldview. Very quickly, 1981, I was teaching at Vanderbilt, and prior to that, I was teaching at Alabama A&M, and one of my students gave me this little 5 or 6 page article. It was called The Cress Theory of Color Confrontation. I put it on my desk, didn't read it for a few days. One night I was teaching a class, and about 30 minutes before class, I picked it up and read it. I immediately got on the phone. Remember when we used to dial 411?
Yeah.
I dialed 411, called Washington, D.C., asked for the number of a Dr. Frances Gress Welsing. She picked up the phone, and I told her, Frances, you don't know who I am. My name is Ray Wimbush, but I just read The Quest Theory of Color Confrontation, and it changed my life. Of all the people that I've invited when I taught at Fisk, when I taught at Vanderbilt, at Morgan State, she has been my most invited guest.
You read that book and you said it changed your life.
It did.
What did it?
Because as her teacher, Neely Fuller, says, racism is not just what white people or a white person does. Dylann Roof, the guy that killed people in Charlotte, he's a racist.
Mm-hmm.
But the system of racism is what she talked about. And as a psychologist, and she was a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. Neely Fuller talks about the what
mm-hmm.
the system is.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Frances does is talk about why do they do it?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that people classified as white don't like people who are darker than them? And she goes through why. The idea that they are a minority but have us calling ourselves minority.
Mm-hmm.
That they are the ones that have more diseases and birth defects when they're born than our children do. So her idea of a system, which is, you know, directly connected to what her teacher, Neely Fuller, said, it intrigued me, and as a psychologist and her being a psychiatrist, it tells me the why. And psychologists, as you know, we're always asking why, mm-hmm. and she answers the question.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something, and I want to put a proviso here. I recently got involved in a project
mm-hmm.
called the Power Talk series,
oh, yeah.
Something that's been going on for several years mm-hmm. now. So, you know, I take no authorship of that
yeah.
whatsoever. I just got involved.
Mm-hmm.
Before I got involved, you had agreed to participate in that Black Talk Forum.
Right.
What made you agree to that, and what do you hope to accomplish? What do you and others hope to accomplish? It's an event that's going to be here in Washington, D.C., the 23rd, 24th. Of June.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, you know, again, other than psychology, I read history a lot. During the 19th century and even part of the late 18th century, black folk had what was then called colored conventions,
mm-hmm.
you know, Negro conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that black folk on a regular basis or a timely basis get together enough and simply talk about what's going on with them.
Yeah.
We do it in the barber shop.
Mm-hmm.
We do it in the beauty shop. We do it on the corner. But our scholars and our activists need to talk to the masses of our people in safe areas where they can share their ideas, feel free to question each other. You know, so when Carl Nelson came up to me and asked me to participate, I said, yeah, because we don't do that enough.
Mm-hmm.
When I taught at FIS, we had the Race Relations Institute, which was founded in the early 1940s, and we brought everybody to the, you know, sons of Marcus Garvey, daughters of Richard Wright, a whole mm-hmm. lot of people that we brought to talk, Frances Welsing. James Earl Jones, mm-hmm. Chuck D, Max Roach, we brought everybody together to talk about racism.
Mm-hmm.
As Frances said, and I totally agree with, the most important things for black folk to talk about right now is white supremacy, because that is the problem of the world. And if we don't talk about it, it's going to not spell our doom, but it's going to make us harder to liberate our people.
You mentioned the name that I was going to bring up come hell or high water before this interview was over. Mm. And you talk about coming together, black
yeah.
folks coming together.
Yeah.
We don't do that. And there is a history that tens of thousands of individuals mm-hmm. came together
right.
in a time that was pulled, and they were pulled together by this powerful force of nature named Marcus Garvey.
Boy.
We've got 2.5 minutes left.
Man, you know, you mentioned the names that are so important to our history. Who was it? I think it was Nkrumah who said that no other book helped him to understand the black struggle on the global basis than the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, before fax machines, email,
hello,
Twitter, Facebook, yeah. and all Instagram, organized 11 million black folk in this country around an idea of Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
I mean, if he could do that in the late teens and early 20s before J. Edgar Hoover and his gang got to him, what should we be doing now?
Yeah.
I say during the 20th century that the greatest organizers, the three great organizers, Elijah Muhammad, Martin Luther King, and Marcus Garvey,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, in that reverse order. So I think that you have to study Garvey to understand the importance of organizing and pulling black folk together for a large vision of Pan-Africanism, which Garvey did and did it the best.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, Elijah Muhammad borrowed from Garvey.
Sure,
Malcolm's father, as you know, was a Garveyite.
Mm-hmm.
And Garvey,
the minister with the Million Man March.
Garvey.
Yeah.
So Garvey influenced. And see, where's the film about Marcus Garvey?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to have a film to mm-hmm. reach the masses of people.
One of my disappointments in President Obama is that he didn't grant that pardon.
No, I know. But see, I'm going to tell you, Rock, I knew he wasn't going to do it. You know, I think it was, what's his name? I can't think of it, but he wrote this article called What Are the Drums Saying? I think when you talk to our people, you either talk to them directly and let white people stand behind you and ignore them, or you talk to white people and you let black folks stand behind you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to say that Barack did, but Barack tried to stand between in the middle of that.
He tried to be in the gap.
Right. And see, my father used to say, Ray, if you're going to be black all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Real simple mm-hmm. from a 12th grade educated man.
Yeah.
But it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
You know, when you want to learn, folks, you invite the professor.
Oh, come on, man.
Brother, thank you so much.
And thank you for asking some great questions.
Blessing us and gracing us
thank
here
you.
Today.
Absolutely.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
All right. Folks, that wraps us for this evening. For more information on this program or any other program produced by WHUT, go to WHUT.org. Goodbye and God bless.
This program was produced by WHUT, Howard University Television, and made possible by contributions from viewers like you. Thank you.
All right, what's up, world? Welcome back again to our Mix What I Like Live. I'm Jared Ball, happy to be your host. Please, again, go to our mixwhatilike.org and subscribe there so you don't miss anything that I and my entire collective crew and expanded community do across a variety of media platforms and forms of communication. So again, mixitoutlike.org there so you don't miss anything that we do. Please do subscribe here, like, retweet, share, all of that good stuff for this channel. And as this conversation goes, please encourage others to join us. And if you see it after the live, please feel free to be in touch with your thoughts as well. Normally, we would want to take a few minutes to talk about political prisoners and all of that and encourage you to involve yourself with that. I want to do that very quickly here, but we want to be respectful and mindful of the time that we have, just about a little over an hour or so with our next guest. So I want to make sure we privilege all of that. So maybe I'll come back at the end and we'll talk up some of that with you as well. Please do get in the chat with your comments. Those of you here live, thank you for joining us, and please do feel free to raise your comments. We'll get to them throughout and as much as possible. And same thing for those who see this after the fact. We'll try to get to those as well. But joining me for this conversation about reparations is one of the most preeminent thinkers on the subject, of course. He is Professor Ray Winbush, who is a research professor and the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. And as a scholar and activist, he is known for his systems thinking approaches to understanding the impact of racism or white supremacy on the global African community. His writings, consultations, and research have been instrumental in understanding developmental stages in black males, public policy, and its connection to compensatory justice, relationships between black males and females, infusion of African studies into school curricula, and the impact of hip-hop culture on the contemporary African landscape. And I would just want to add one thing, as we said, of one of our previous guests recently, Lynn Washington. I would have to say the same thing for Professor Winbush here, somebody who people would have to understand through working with him off the record and outside of the public eye and often behind the scenes, how supportive he is to a number of faculty on campuses where he works and elsewhere. We always have to big that up because it's not a given that people, particularly at the senior levels that he has reached, will be supportive of junior faculty, and particularly those who take certain positions politically where they work. So I just wanted to take that moment to thank Dr. Winbush for his personal support of me and many others that I've seen over the years working with him at Morgan State University. And without further ado, Dr. Winbush, thank you again for joining us, and good morning to you.
Good to see you, Jared, Brother Jared. Good to be here.
So always happy to talk to you. And when I was still doing the Academics in Cars series, we were trying to set that up, and through my own scheduling, we couldn't get that to happen. So, you know, I guess if there is a fortunate to this COVID moment, it's a chance to catch up with people, at least, you know, virtually. So I'm glad to do this with you. And you know, given your, again, expertise, which we will talk about over the course of this next hour on the issue of reparations, I wanted to start with this broad question, again, that accepting they are due, not debating whether or not reparations are due, accepting that they are due, how do you think they should be handled going forward, especially given the moment we're in now?
Well, that's a debate even among reparations activists. There's a lot of schools of thought. Probably the most recent one, which I tend to reject, is that has been brought forth by Sandy Darity in his new book. I know Sandy very well, but it's almost like a money only with him. He brings forth and did a study that said that reparations in terms of being owed is something like $6.25 quadrillion. Now, that's a ridiculous figure as far as I'm concerned, but being on C-SPAN and all these other shows, it kind of trivializes what reparations are all about. I think the money-only approach is something that is really something that is pushed by the right wing to again, trivialize reparations. I think it's like, Jared, the civil rights movement, if you want to make that fairly good comparison, that in 1954, you know, after Brown v. Board, of course, that auspiciously was about school desegregation. But spinoffs of that included, you know, open housing, Voting Rights Act, affirmative action, all of that. I think the reparations can take the form of money payments. I do believe that. I think it can take the form of repatriation. You know, my brothers and sisters in the Caribbean said, look, give me $100,000 and I'm out of here. You know, I'm going back to Africa. It can take the form, and I'm just thinking of some of the debates we've had among ourselves, you know, about a reparations bank that would be run by a committee and so forth, which is more capitalistic. My colleague Charles Barron, an assemblyman up in New York, and, you know, we've done a lot of work there. He said, look, don't give anybody any money because all you're going to do is pour it back into the very system that created the problem in the first place. So there's a lot of thoughts. I think land is another one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of my colleagues have talked about that. So it's the debate is still there, but what we all agree on is that they owe us in some form.
Could you expand on that point you raised a little bit about the if I understood you correctly, the conservative nature of a money-only approach? Why would, I mean, because I think a lot of people who would hear that might, at least initially, disagree with your assertion. In other words, when black people turn on the TV and they see Sandy Darity or anyone else saying, you owe us, you know, quadrillion, however, what was it? I forgot the number, $6 quadrillion.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, six, and they get specific, 6.25 quadrillion. I mean, I could imagine a lot of people thinking, start, you know, cheering him and thinking this is, you know, go brother, go, like, you know, get us that, you know, get us that check as we, you know, why do you disagree consider that to be a conservative,
Well, another person that espouses the money only is Robert Johnson, the former CEO of BET. He had a very, very, or has a very, very simple formula. He says, give every man, woman, and black baby, you know, I mean, literally $350,000 a year cash, tax-free. And that amounts roughly to about $14 trillion, which is in the neighborhood of where most people think it should be.
You mean a one-time payment of $350,000?
Right. So if you have your wife, two children, you would get, what is that, 350 times four. That family would get that, even if that baby is 18 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you then eliminate issues like affirmative action. You eliminate people saying, well, we want set-asides and all of that, as if the money cures everything. And it doesn't. It's like saying, you know, years ago, we were going to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, and then there will be no more discrimination against women, you know, or we got Brown v. Board, and there won't be any more racism. So I think that money-only approaches, I am not opposed at all to giving money for reparations. I mean, I can cite some examples that have already been done where money was involved. But if that's all it is, I think it gives a more, it's almost like somehow money is going to cure all of the problems and also release the society, specifically the United States, from any other obligations toward African people. And I don't believe that.
Almost kind of like saying, you know, Obama got elected, so your political issues are taken care of now, something like that, you know, yeah.
And which McConnell essentially said when they were talking about reparations, well, you got Barack Obama, like, wow, you know, I'm supposed to be satisfied now. So that actually was said by Mitch McConnell.
Well, that's actually, you know, it's interesting. I plan to bring this up, but we might as well do it here. It's a good segue, you know, because some have argued, similar to that, well, why should I don't want to get, you know, I'm accepting that reparations are due, but some have argued that one reason that they're not is because not only have we been given Obama, but historically we've been given voting rights acts and civil rights acts and affirmative action, and we've been made citizens and all of these things that are supposedly have opened the door to opportunity and boundless opportunity. But anyway, so, which is also I've seen led to the debate is, well, when should we count the total number owed? Should it start from enslavement, or should we even just start from Jim Crow?
I think we should start from 1441. you know, I'm going all the way back to when the first Africans were taken out of the continent and put on Madeira Island by the Portuguese. I would start at 1441, and I would probably end, you know, yesterday. I mean,
what time is it now?
yeah, 11:10 or something, you know. So, I mean, I think that with, you know, I think the society somehow feels that, you know, I've heard over and over, white people have said to me in presentations on racism, on reparations, they'll say something like, well, didn't we sacrifice 600,000 men during the Civil War?
Oh, wow.
You know, so, wow, you know. Then I ask them immediately how many black people died in the Civil War, and they don't know. You know, as if the you know, what they did in the Civil War. So it's like, I think white people are always looking for absolutions from the sins of the past. And I think doing that about money only with reparations is another nuanced approach to that. And so also it says, well, if we do that, isn't that enough? And the answer is no. I mean, it'll be enough, you know, like Derrick Bell, you know, the late Derrick Bell said that racism is always going to be here. And everything that you do to expand it, you know, make it grow and everything is another, you know, point at which you've got to do something about it. Now, until we get rid of racism, you know, and you let me know, I mean, my ridiculous colleague Dinesh D'Souza, who wrote a book a few years ago called The End of Racism, and I bought it because I wanted to know when it ended. Was
right.
It June 8th, I don't know, 1999 or when?
Did he give a definitive stop date for it?
No, he just said it was ended because, you know, I mean, we saw that with Obama's election, you know, we're post-racial. No. I mean, those are some of the myths that I think Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about in his books and his writings about that somehow this country is always wanting to escape its responsibility while telling us, black folk and indigenous people, to be responsible and take responsibility. Well, let them take responsibility on certain things.
Well, again, that's interesting. You've led me to another point I wanted to raise with you, which is this. So I'm happy. There need not be any order to it. But Ta-Nehisi Coates, in many ways, representing a lot of the popular scholarship on the issue, or conversation at least on the issue, is a proponent of reparations. Wrote a very famous defense for the case for reparations. What impact do you think that people like him or other popular discussants of reparations, even those who say they are proponents of it? So, for instance, in other words, you know, I just said the other day with Adolf Reed that I disagreed with him, that I don't think Bernie Sanders was necessarily a net positive in the promotion of socialism, even though he, you know, is often claimed to have made it more popular a concept. I don't believe that. Is Coates, you know, does he help your argument and your effort, or the effort of those with whom you work on this issue?
I think everybody helps in a little ways, in small ways about reparations. I mean, Randall Robinson at the turn of the century, you know, wrote a book, The Debt, that I think, in fact, my book about reparations, my first book about reparations, The Debt, was an answer to his question, The Debt, Should America Pay? And I made an argument, you know, within the book with other authors about the empirical history of reparation. Well, I think that Ta-Nehisi did something that I haven't done in my presentation of reparations. Usually I start with the past, you know, 40 Acres and the Mule, Belinda Royale Sutton, and move forward. What Coates did, to his credit, is start now with the mortgage ripoffs that had been occurring for decades in Chicago and move backwards to the Civil War, tracing one family in particular. And by the time you get to reading that article, which I think was the brilliance of it, you say, we got to do something about this. So he started in the present and moved to the past. I should usually start in the past and move to the present. And I think that, you know, so I've gotten a lot of calls, well, you know, from housing. I did something a couple weeks ago with New York Housing Authority, because they were saying, well, we've got all this redlining stuff, that historical, what should we do about it? That's probably thanks to Coates. So I think everybody adds arguments to it. You know, my colleague Wade Nobles out in California, he makes, you know, an argument for the idea of psychological reparations. So people like, you know, Lil Wayne, you know, he just sold the rights to his music for $100 million. But so he doesn't need the money, but I think there may be, and you know, with all due respect to Lil Wayne, he may need psychological reparations. And Wade makes a contribution about that. So I think everybody adds a little to the argument, including Coates. It's not perfect, because if you read his article, Coates never at the end of the article says, this is how much it should be. You know, I'm glad Sandy said there should be $6.25 quadrillion. And although that's an absurd figure, it at least shows the magnitude of how much occurred to Africans after they were stolen from the continent.
Yeah, somebody was raising the question here, what happened to the $17 trillion? And I was saying what happened to it is it became $6.25 quadrillion. I don't even know what that number is or how many zeros that even looks. I don't even know what that looks like in print. But you know, when I hear that argument, and one reason why I think that some versions of reparations are more welcomed, and particularly on commercial media spaces like that, is because when people hear that figure, it's understood, particularly in those spaces, that white audiences who hear that are going to think, my God, that is a ridiculous number. We're not paying that. And then it can be easily dismissed. So on the one hand, you get the credit for making it seem like you're on, you know, CNN or whatever, or C-SPAN making the argument. But the hosts and the directors and the owners of those networks know that it's not going to get anywhere. So that's one part of a reason why I've personally taken to arguing something slightly differently, which admittedly has been accused in some spaces of not supporting reparations. So I want to hear your thoughts on this in particular. Sure. So just tactically speaking, any reparative project, particularly one that would transfer wealth, would require a large segment of white Americans to sign off on that. And I just can't see them doing that. I can't see them saying we're going to transfer wealth just to black people. So I said, well, then why don't we just make the target for redistribution, at least before COVID, the $20 trillion gross domestic product of the country, and just say in perpetuity, X percent of that GDP is going to get redistributed to everybody so that we have free health care, free housing, free schools. Everybody has a job. Everybody has job training. Everybody has clean water. I mean, everything. Like, the roads get paid. Like, so instead of the 1% getting a lion's share, that $20 trillion, all of us get it. And that way we don't have to have the arguments over, you know, I don't want my, you know, white people saying we didn't own anybody, why should we pay? And Asians saying, well, we suffer too. And this group saying we suffer too. And then within the diaspora, I mean, you've already touched on it already, there's an international aspect to reparations to your approach, but others are saying, but, you know, only black people here should get it, and to the exclusion of any, even the solidarity work with any other group. So I'm saying to just tactically get around all of that, redistribute everything, and then once that is done within our own communities, all those other reparative projects can be taken up, spiritual, psychological, et cetera. What do you think of that? What is... Well, what's wrong with my argument?
Well, this is what I hate to say, well, this is what's wrong with your argument.
No, it's, I mean, it's cool, you know.
The reason I actually think that the approach of being more specific to the group where the injury occurred is more conservative than your argument. That I don't conceive this society ever getting to a point that is more socialistic, not a la Bernie Sanders, but just saying, why don't we just redistribute wealth? Why don't we have a system that gets rid of the Jeff Bezos and some of these other fat cats and let everybody have a decent living, a decent education, health care, and so forth? I actually think that black reparations are much easier. And see, the other thing, Jared, is that the other thing is that it's like nobody, that radical president Ronald Reagan gave reparations to the Japanese who had been interned during World War II. Native Americans, not all of them, but some of the Lakota, some of the Klamaths of Oregon, they have gotten reparations. And we've seen concomitant raising of health care because of, you know, money. This dude in the White House was complaining that his, you know, some of his gambling casinos collapsed because of, you know, indigenous people who don't have to pay tax on that stuff. I think that there's, again, a lot of ways of doing reparation. One that I should have mentioned, I guess, I mean, there's a school of thought among the reparations activists that said, look, black folk just don't pay taxes for the next 25 years. And when I'm saying no taxes, I'm talking about no income tax, no sales tax, no property tax, no type of tax, no payroll tax. And that's a form of reparations. And I know a lot of people who are very strong on that issue. So I think that my plan or our plan is more feasible than say, let's just redistribute wealth altogether.
Maybe you're right. I was just thinking in terms of the amount of support needed for that to happen. I was thinking if everybody's getting something, then everybody would be more likely to support it. But maybe you're right. I think that's a legit response.
I mean, this is my feeling. You know, when I was looking at the Black Lives Matter demonstration for Breonna and George Floyd last summer, like, the only time, and correct me if I'm wrong, the only time that white people have ever fought white people on behalf of black people was the American Civil War. And then 12 years after that, the so-called Compromise of 1877, they abandoned us to give Rutherford B. Hayes elected president. And I've told young people, you know, since last summer, I said, look, don't count on white people to help you with your struggle. I mean, it's like, as I have told, you know, Palestinians, don't count on some kind of alliance with Israel to help you get free. You know, I think that white people are always going to resist anything that they perceive as somehow taking from them. I don't care what it is. I mean, they did it throughout our history. You know, John Hope Franklin was my teacher when I was at Chicago doing my degree, and his dad, Buck Franklin, was the lawyer for those who were, you know, killed in the Tulsa Massacre that will celebrate their 100th anniversary, or not celebrate, or commemorate the 100th anniversary next year. Well, Dr. Franklin used to say, he said, I don't care what it is, whenever black people seemingly are making an advance about anything, you know, white people are going to oppose it. So white opposition to reparations is like, that's part of the struggle. We know that. I'm heartened when I see that double the amount of white people now support reparations as opposed to 10 years ago. And much of that support, in quotation marks, came as a result of the demonstrations last summer. But I just never rely on white people to do anything without kicking and screaming to the table.
Yeah, that's why I keep thinking if the argument is particularly the poorer ones, you will benefit too, and you don't have to think of this as being specific help for Black people or repair for Black people, that they would be more likely to do it. But it's the logic of white supremacy is illogical, so it's hard
exactly.
to track it. So I don't know, and you may I just have to keep thinking about your point. I don't know, and that's why in general I just support these efforts. But I do want to come back to that point you raised, at least a little bit of the international aspect of this, because if as your approach, and one I would agree with, particularly as a Pan-Africanist, that it go back to 1441 and count everybody, well then, so are you saying that the reparations movement be organized internationally and then collectively collect the debt collectively from the West? Or are you saying that each individual African community collectively working go to their particular colonial administrator, for lack of a better word, for repair?
I think both. I reject the notion that ADOS, the American Descendants of Slaves, what a terrible name, but I reject their notion that we should just think about us. And I reject the whole idea. First, let me just say this. The reparation struggle has always been international. It has never been just about my thing and forget about everybody else. I think that like the CARICOM community, the Caribbean community, is very organized about reparations, but they also help us and we help them. And we've been cooperative in a lot of different ways. I did a workshop with Hillary Beckles in Scotland and was surprised a few years ago and was surprised to see several African people in Europe with their own reparation struggle. So we help each other. The idea that ADOS, and I don't want to make this about ADOS, but the idea that somehow we should only think about ourselves in this landmass and not think about our brothers and sisters, throughout the diaspora, to me is just ridiculous. And other thing, you got to look at where ADOS is coming from. I mean, they're funded primarily by, anti-immigration white folks from the far right, many of whom are Trump supporters and others. So I think they've got another motive that they don't like to uncover about or expose to the public. So I think it's international, and I've always viewed it as international. And not only me, but anybody who's a true Pan-African sees it as international.
Yeah, that's why we only drink soda here. Solidarity of Dispersed Africans, thanks
right.
Dr. Ichile, and please go check the talk we just had with her this morning, folks. If you didn't see it, it was great. and Blood Honey, I put it at the bottom.